Okay, back on after a short break.
So
So
where?
we'd been talking about publishing and writing at Stanford, and I mean, I think we were pretty much kind of closing up your time at Stanford, so.
Yeah, so now the next so my graduate years were happy years. They were fun years. They were affluent years, as I pointed out. They were also much too short for what they should have been. Okay, I mean, I finished in a little bit less than 4 years, mostly because I needed to finish in less than 4 years. So my wife was very pregnant at the time, and she very much wanted to build a nest before she gave birth. So she said, "We need to be somewhere. Wherever it is that we're going, we need to be there where we're living this baby, because there's got to be a nest that we have to." So I sort of rushed through the end that I probably left 6 months earlier than I should have left. When my students tell me, you know, how long is it going to take me to get a PhD, I say, you know, if you're having fun, try to make it as long as possible, because life gets a little bit more stressful afterwards, and you won't have, nobody will ever pay you again to learn as much as you're learning right now. I had family reasons of my own doing, okay, but you know, we had to finish, and we did. At that time, there were two choices, two career choices for me. One of which was to go into academia, and that's what my advisor said I should do. And the other one was to, I forgot to tell you, Jack Weicker had taken me every year in graduate school out
Oh,
to
he
dinner,
continued in graduate
twice a
school.
year,
Okay.
okay, and would take my wife for the last six of those because she was
Wow.
already there. And Jack Weicker, by the way, is still alive. He's 94 years old. He lives in Delaware in a little cottage by, you know, and about a year ago, he wrote me a card because I got an award from the AICHE, and he said, "Congratulations, I hope you remember me." I said, "How can I not remember you? I had more
Right.
dinners with you than I did with my wife." And he says, "And I hope you will allow me to take some credit for your success." Okay, so this is another one of those persons who, again, took an interest in me from the very beginning when nobody should have taken an interest, and sort of to this day still keeps track of me. Okay,
Yeah.
it's, so anyway, so I could have gone to Exxon. I could have gone to Chevron. I got an offer from Chevron here. Or I could have interviewed in academia, which was the path that my advisor sort of has set out for me.
Now, did the majority of his graduate students go into academia? Was that kind of the norm for his group?
He had a history. He has a history for having built sort of an academic pyramid, because he has been the most influential of all sort of pyramid points in the United States in the area of heterogeneous catalysis. To the point that sometimes the group is affectionately or not so affectionately called the Woodard Mafia or the Woodard Clan, or but there probably throughout the year been about 10 of us that has sort of continued to reproduce. And you know, by the time we put his tree together, it was clear that there were a lot of very fertile people that had reproduced a lot. So there was a history that his best students went to academia and they did quite well. I have to say that I was terrified to go to academia. I mean, I had just finished working for 4 years on a fairly narrow problem. I had no idea what I would do if I had to start raising my own children at this point. And I don't know how anybody can get a PhD and then a year later begin to train their own PhD. So,
Right.
I mean, I think that there is a problem about children having children there that concerned me a great deal. Not openly and not that I could articulate, but it was clearly something that I didn't think that I was ready to do it. So I had the conversation with him and I said, you know, I'm not sure that I'm an academic at heart to begin with, but I certainly am sure that I wouldn't know what to do if I went to academia now. And he said, "Well, fine, so why don't you go to Exxon? They have a corporate research labs that they're trying to expand." And several of his students had actually gone there
Oh.
and then gone to academia afterwards. So he said, "Well, go there, Okay, and then in 5 years I'll come and rescue you. So I went there. I mean, I went back to New Jersey. Now, the weather was not a great surprise to me, but it was for my wife.
Okay. And this is up in Annandale?
Yeah, this is in Annandale. Except Annandale was not there at the time. So Annandale was in the planning stages. They had bought the land. The building had not been completed. And they had an awful place in Linden, New Jersey, across from the Bayway Refinery, that was literally dated back to the early 1900s. And but I was promised that it was only temporary. So we lived where the new building was going to go, okay, and then I would commute, you know, all the way to Linden for 2 years until we finally moved there in 1985. The job at Chevron was interesting. It was also a very good offer, but they didn't have anybody with the charm and persistence of Jack Weichert.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it paid less. And you think that California is expensive now. California was more expensive than anywhere else then yet. So I didn't know how I was going to raise a child, you know, keep a wife, okay, and be able to buy a house. And if we stayed here, and that's where we decided that we were going to battle the weather. But we said one day when we can afford it, we will come back. Now it turns out that we came back and we couldn't afford it. But, you know, that's besides the point. Okay, we did come back, so at least half of it was right. Okay, but we were poor for a while when we came back. So I went to Exxon in late 1981. We got there at the end of the, I guess, October of 1981, and my wife deliver the baby December 31st of 1981.
So you got there just in time.
Just in time. We were all pushing very hard. And because I was commuting to, and Daniel was a terrible child. Okay. He was very nice later on in life, but we when he was a baby, he was the absolute most colicky baby anybody has ever known. Okay. And my wife and I would take turns, you know, trying to calm him down and all that. But then the good thing about the commute, it was a 1 hour commute all the way to Linden in a van pool. I would just sleep there and sleep on the way back, okay, and then I was fresh when I got there to be able to relieve my wife. But it was a very stressful year at that point. We saw we would not have any other children. You know, that didn't work too long. Amnesia, I guess, kicked in. The corporate research labs of Exxon were at a very interesting time, and it was a time when a couple of years earlier, the company had decided that we were going to run out of oil. They do that on a regular basis, you know, and that therefore they were going to have to get into things that were not oil. And they wanted to get into electronics. They bought an electric motor company. They wanted to get into photovoltaics. They wanted to do computers and photocopiers. I mean, this was Exxon, you know, sort of giving up their roots because they were going to run out of oil. And in order to do that, they needed to create a laboratory that would parallel the Bell Laboratories, right? So they took a former manager from whatever AT&T was called at the time. I guess it was called AT&T, who had been Nixon's science advisor. This is someone by the name of Ed David, okay? And they said, we want to build the Bell Laboratories of the oil industry. And I guess I was part of the staff that was hired in order to make that, the Bell Laboratories of the oil industry, except that I was one of the few that had a chemical engineering degree, because they began to hire, you know, physicists and chemists and mathematicians and all that in order to be able to create, you know, this center of excellence that, out of his sheer neural connections, was going to make the next transistor happen, right? And then Exxon will be able to live again after oil had been depleted. Okay, so that obviously didn't come to pass, right? 4 years later, they decided that we weren't going to run out of oil, that, you know, that they didn't have enough money in order to maintain the staff that they had put together at that lab, and overnight in 1986, 4 years after I got there, the labs were cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved in 1985 by 84. By 1986, the lab was half of what it used to be. And I guess I survived that mostly by being young and invisible. Okay, but it was a very it was a very traumatic moment for me to sort of watch the human impact of a series of misguided decisions where the decision makers were never affected, but the people who followed the decisions were actually disrupted. And,
right.
And there were a lot of people around me at that early and impressionable age that had a very difficult life as a result of what others had decided. The people that were paid a large amount of money to plan for the future made a miscalculation, and all of a sudden humans along the way get hurt. In a sense, in a perverse sort of way, I think it was also a career changer for me. Because they had not hired very many people after I was hired. Then the laboratory was decimated in 1986, and all of a sudden I was unique in a different way. I was almost the only one in my age group. I was one of the very few that actually had the chemical engineering background that they needed now that they were getting back into the oil business again. And on top of that, Exxon had a way of sort of psychoanalyzing you to try to figure out what is it. I mean, they didn't do it in any malicious sort of way. They did it in order to find out what you would be best at doing, right? And I gather from the results of those experiments, okay, that they had decided that actually I was someone who should be in management rather than science. To be honest with you, I don't know why, other than I have gotten, as a function of age, very good at compensating for my shortcomings. So I can look like an extrovert in the right environment. I can look like I really care about your problems. There's a word for that, but my vocabulary is emphatic, I guess is the way to put it. So I'm not hiding my feelings. I'm trying to make you feel better, right? But it is something that I do to compensate for my natural tendency that if you walk into my office with a problem, I say, go work on your problem, okay? Don't bother me by talking about it, okay? But somehow, somewhere along the way, okay, I was identified as one of those people that would be given more responsibility. Honestly, I don't know. Nobody asked me along the way whether that's what I wanted to do, but it is very it sort of puts you to sleep a little bit when people give you more responsibility, they give you more money, and they say, you know, we're doing this because you think technically, because we think technically you're very good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you begin to move through the organization, you have more responsibility. You don't realize for the moment that the higher up in the organization, the less your technical skills are probably essential.
Right.
And the more of those skills that I was compensating for because I didn't have become more essential. So so I became a group leader, then I became a section head. And
all the while you're doing less and less
science.
Less and less science, yeah.
Right. In a way, I look back at it and I said, you know, I was pretty clever, okay? Because every time that they gave me the responsibility, I sort of made the pact with the devil, okay, so to speak. And that is that, yeah, I will take the responsibility, but you have to give me resources to continue to do some science. So when I became a group leader, there was an additional technician that came into my group, and then I was able, and he was very, very good. I mean, Joe Baumgartner doesn't even have a bachelor's degree, but he could get a PhD anywhere. Okay, and he sort of became—he was one of the people, along with my children, that convinced me that I could actually teach people how to do things. okay, because he was so bright and he learned so quickly. So the pact with the devil was I would do some administration, but then I would get resources so I could keep my science going. Then when I became a section head, and now I had, you know, 50 people in my group, okay, I said I need a postdoc in order to be able to do that. So at every point along the way, I was sort of agreeing to do something that seemed like they were rewarding me by giving me the responsibility, but still sort of keeping the science going.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what happened as a function of time was that the administrative component became more and more onerous, not in the number of people, but in the amount of administration. To put this in context, Exxon Valdez, okay, mm-hmm. happened along the ways when I was acquiring that responsibility. The company became much more structured in the way that they did things to make sure that all procedures were documented and, you know, that the company went by the book and everything. And that generated a lot of administrative overhead that sort of fell on me to do. And even though I had a laboratory and I had people working in there and they were productive, they were providing the few publications that bought me the exit visa to come here
mm-hmm.
afterwards, I was not getting directly involved in what they were doing. Okay, they were doing very well because they were very good, but I wasn't doing the science myself. Which explains at least in part why I came here, where I began to somehow micromanage the group a little bit, because I never wanted to be detached from what was going on in the lab, otherwise the group would grow to a size that I couldn't manage anymore, and I would feel that I was no longer indispensable. In other words, that
right.
anybody could do it if I'm not there doing it with them. It was a time where life was moving so quickly. I was getting so little sleep because we were having three children at the time, okay? And everything sort of was the equivalent of the fog of war, I think, at that point. My career was moving very smoothly. Everybody thought that this was a success story. Everybody seemed perfectly happy with my ability to do more and more responsible things. But I was less and less comfortable with how I was using my time. And I think what happened is what people dismissively call a midlife crisis. Okay, I happen to have a very scientific sort of rationale for what people call midlife crisis. I came to the age of 36 or 37, okay, and I said, you know, what do I want to accomplish for the rest of my life? And if it was becoming the vice president of corporate research, it was probably attainable. But it would have required certain sacrifices. I would have to give my scientific output. I would have to move and sort of get experiences within the company and so on. And then I would look at a vice president position and say, is this really what I want to do for the rest of my life? And the answer was clearly no. Okay. I remember distinctly at the time so what precipitated this? What precipitated was the fact that the next job that I would have, okay, would be a job outside of New Jersey, would be outside of corporate research, and it would be in either Texas or Louisiana.
Mm.
So now I go back to the comments that I made earlier about my own willingness to go to certain parts of the country where I thought my children would grow up with that, an acceptance of others that were different than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that was the path that I would have had to follow. So even if I wanted, okay, to ultimately end up in that kind of a job, it would have required that I do something that I thought was not for the family the right thing to do.
Right.
I have to say that the family, the children in particular, didn't think that moving to California was such a good idea, but then they changed their minds after a while. but I was, at that point, I was going through on the little time that I had to think, because my life was moving so quickly, I had to begin to think about all these things. Plus, I think the realization that there was a window beyond which, if I had stayed there
mm-hmm.
and I had detached myself from the science, there was no way that I was ever going to go to academia. That it would be very difficult at Exxon at the time for me to go back and become a scientist again.
Mm-hmm.
And that I had gone to to Exxon in order to finish my education, right? So that perhaps I should now consider academia, listening to my advisor all along, with now a much more polished knowledge of what life was all about and
right.
what research was all about and what areas were important and so on. And I have to say that the education that I got at those labs, that, you know, from the comments that I have made, perhaps looks negative rather than positive, was always positive. Everybody was doing what they thought was the right thing for me. They just forgot to ask me what I wanted to do, but that's because they were so excited about what they were doing for me. I got to work with some of the best people that anybody has ever worked. I mean, that lab has a history, just like Michel Boudard's group, of being the place that populates academic positions, because the people there are at the top of their field, they're doing first-rate science, and it is very fundamental in nature. But also, the people, for the most part, in spite of the fact that the company, it's a very assertive, arrogant company, the people there were anything but that. I mean, they were people there like the Gary McVickers of the world, the John Sinfelds of the world. I mean, these were people that were well known for
yeah.
doing first-rate research. And yet, I could walk into their offices anytime, go to the whiteboard, okay, and ask them to help me with a problem. I also have to say that that was the disappointment of coming to academia, is that professors are much more of a compartment than scientists in industry are, and that it is very difficult for me to do what I used to do with John Sinfeld or Gary McVicker or Stu Solid, okay, than it is for me to go and walk into somebody else's office here and do the same kind of technical exchange. But I mean, I was involved in projects that were, I worked on their advanced gas conversion project, okay, which was going into large-scale pilot plant. I did both the fundamentals and the engineering part of it. I got to learn about bubbles going through liquids, which had nothing to do with catalysis or what I do. And I got to work with some of the smartest people that I have ever worked with, including Berkeley faculty members. And I did that while getting a very good salary, a salary that was even higher as a result of the management responsibility, which is what made it so painful to come to Berkeley
yeah.
afterwards. Okay. So I approached, let me know when we get close to,
mm-hmm.
so how long are we going to go, 3:30?
If 3:30, if that works
yeah.
for your schedule?
Yeah, well, that's
yeah.
fine. So Michel Boudard was a consultant at Exxon, but I was very concerned about talking to him about that midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
During the consulting visits, because I thought this was Exxon paying for his time.
Right.
Right. I had been a consulting professor at Stanford for 3 years, and that meant that I came every summer, for a few weeks, okay, and I taught a short course. I worked with Michelle's group. I wanted to do it. So Michelle told me that I should do this in order to get sort of, that was the pressure valve, the pressure relief valve from my life, because he was noticing that I was a little bit stressed over there. I don't think he had any indications or any feelings that I would actually use this as sort of a test
mm-hmm.
of whether I would like to do that. But that's exactly what I was doing. I was looking at whether I could sit for 4 weeks and watch academics and graduate students and whether I would be able to sort of survive in that kind of an environment. But I never had the conversation with him while I would come out to Stanford. I actually had it during one of his visits, on one evening when I said, we're going out to dinner, but I'm paying for dinner tonight. Okay. And he said, no, I'll pay for dinner. I said, no, I'm paying for dinner tonight. Okay. So we went out to dinner, and I said, you told me that you would come rescue me in 5 years, and you forgot about me. So here's my Catholic guilt giving back. somehow. And he said something like, I thought you were too happy to move you anywhere. You know, everybody that looked at it said that, you know, he forgot about science. He's going to become a manager and, you know, we'll never have it back in academia. And I said, well, that's because, you know, I do the job that they ask me to do, and I do it well enough that they want to give me the next job. But if I went on strike right now and I said, I don't want to do this anymore, okay, I'm not sure what would happen. So I'm not going to do that, but I'm ready to consider other options. And he said, other industrial options or academic options? I said, no, if I want to work in industry, I cannot think of a better place than Exxon in order to do it. I'll take my chances, I'll go back into the laboratory. It'll take me 5 years before they accept me, because now I have gone to the dark side and now I'm coming back to the bench again, but that's okay. I'll take my time and I'll prove myself to be pure again and get away with it. So it will be an academic position. And so you went, I said, well, I'll make some phone calls, you know, and see what happens. And, you know, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I had three phone calls.
Okay? Wow.
Within 6 weeks, I had three interviews, one semi-official. And within probably 2.5 months, I had offers from three places. And this was too fast for me.
I was moving really fast.
Yeah, okay, so now I don't have time to prepare the family. I can't begin to act out so that they notice I'm unhappy, right? You know, I can't do the drama routine in order to be able to convince them to do this, right? So this is the point where they really thought of, my wife thought, he's having a breakdown now. You know, it's time to intervene here somehow. There were some difficult choices to make. I mean, one of them was that one of the offers was from Delaware.
Okay.
Who was probably the number 4 or 5 chemical engineering department, and it was a much better offer than the other two. Hmm. It was in a more conservative East Coast environment that my wife had adjusted to the climate and actually liked that kind of environment. And she clearly remembered California as the wild place where we spent our childless years, and wasn't sure that she wanted to raise children in such a wild place as the one that we lived in. And the people at Delaware were so charming that it was clear that I was going to have to work very hard in order to do anything else. Berkeley made the second best offer and included a significant amount of charm in the equation. And the charm came because at the time the chair of the department, Morton Dent, was a very charming individual, but also because he enlisted the help of several of the former members of the department, the emeritus professors, that had some of the old world charm that that he didn't have. So I came in and they treated me not particularly well, but then when I came with my wife, okay, then they brought out all the charming people, okay, in order to charm me. So I remember a famous dinner with Charles Tobias, who's one of the fathers of this department. And I didn't know what the seating arrangement was, but they insisted that my wife sit next to him. Okay. and you know, he was, I think, instrumental in sort of making her forget that this was not the place where she wanted to raise children. And then we took 3 days. It was one of the first times that we left the children with their grandparents. And I rented a convertible, and we went up north on the Golden Gate Bridge with the top down, okay? And by the time the end of those 3 days, you know, we were not making any calculations. We said, you know, it's either Stanford or Berkeley. It's not Delaware anymore. So we crossed that threshold. Stanford actually they either did not make an offer or they made the worst offer. I cannot remember exactly what they did, because I don't think I ever got a piece of paper. But clearly they were very concerned about whether I could teach or not.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very concerned about tenure. And here I was at 37. I had been out for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had, you know, 25 publications or so. And I wasn't about to move a family with 3 children and then have to go through a 10-year process
right.
in order to do that. And also, by the time all was said and done, I think that we would have been able to get over that hurdle. But there was clearly the expectation that I would replace Michel Boudard, because he was retiring at the time.
Okay.
And that was a bit much for me, because I didn't want sort of the responsibility of having to live to their expectation that I would become one of the giants in the field and take his place.
Right. Shoes like that are hard to fill, to step they
are
right into that. It's almost impossible to live up to whatever the expectation is then.
Right. And again, I didn't want that as a responsibility or as an objective. My objective was to do science and to see how good I could be at doing science on my own, you know, as a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the, so I'll give you two pieces of my background that somehow later on became clear to me. One of them is that I'm the first college graduate from my family, but I'm also the first one that is not a businessman. So there is something in the genes or in my history that says that I wanted this control that I wanted over my surroundings perhaps could be best achieved by being in business by myself. And really, academics are a lot more like, you know, sole owner proprietors than they are anything else, right? The other one, and this is something that I did not know until 2007, is that it turns out that my great-grandfather was the teacher in the village.
Hmm.
So in 2007, I go back, and for the first time, I return to the village where my father was born.
Oh, wow.
I had never met my family there, but I have aunts and all that. And they took me to the church. They took me to the old school where my father had gone. They found people there. See, I remember your dad. He was really smart, okay? And then they took me to the cemetery where my ancestors, and on top of it, it says, Casa del Maestro, the house of the teacher. Everybody in my family had been buried under what is known the house of the teacher, because my great-grandfather was actually the teacher, and there was no school, so they brought him to his house. He would teach everybody all the grades, you know,
wow,
up to some place. So there's some sort of teaching in my genetic code somehow. They would select the smartest, and so I mean, this was the time when teachers were highly recognized. This were the smartest ones of the community. They're the ones that effectively became the house of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I had no idea this. I had to give a speech afterwards because I got a doctor honoris causa from Valencia, and I told the story about how, unbeknownst to me, actually there were some genetic pool that should take me to academia because I came from the house of the teacher, and also it would make me a businessman because everybody else in my family had never done science. They had always done business. It was still difficult to decide between Berkeley and Delaware because the offer was so much better. The housing was so much cheaper,
mm-hmm,
there. My family, I think, would have been probably less disrupted by the move. The environment looked the same. The houses were East Coast type,
yeah,
and there was open space and all that. And one of the reasons I didn't go, well, there were two reasons. First of all, I thought that Berkeley was a little bit like me. A little bit different than any other place around, okay? And that this place really was more of a cross-section of society than either Stanford and Delaware were. Stanford, to some extent, is a bit too orderly for my taste. This place has the randomness of, and also the reputation for,
mm-hmm,
a level of political openness that is no longer here, by the way, but the reputation still is. And that, you know, this, I wanted to be in a place that was accepting of others. This was the antithesis of moving to the South and being treated the way that I was treated at Princeton or the way that I was treated in Baton Rouge or Texas. And that I wanted to be in a place like that. And,
mm-hmm,
I wanted to sort of contribute to the heterogeneity of the place. And the other one that is that Delaware had some of the brightest people in chemical engineering at the time, but they were all my age.
Hmm.
So we were all within 6 to 8 months of each other.
Oh, wow.
And I said, you know, if I walk in there, we're all going to be fighting for attention at the same time. It's like having quintuplets, okay? We all want to be fed at the same time, okay? And I think it's going to be difficult to sort of keep this department together. And sure enough, I mean, most of those people either moved into administration or left and all,
mm-hmm,
that, because it couldn't contain that much talent with the same needs at the same time.
Interesting.
And that was actually more thoughtful than I intended to be, but it was clearly something that concerned me a great deal. So here we are, okay, and I think it's probably okay that I spent a little bit of time because it may be better to leave the Berkeley experience for tomorrow. So
sure.
It's self-contained,
yeah.
Okay, it is more recent. But there's some things about the transition that I think were probably marking or at least interesting to hear. So here's someone who is very concerned about controlling his surroundings. That's me. The immigrant never wants to be in a position to have to go back again, you know, to sort of have the infrastructure crumble one more time and be left with two pieces of luggage and you have to start all over again. And therefore, it is not in the nature of the immigrant to be impulsive in the way that they give up a perfectly reasonable position for one that may be potentially better,
right.
Okay, but not necessarily in a material way, in a practical way. A few things happened, okay, so one of them was I was sitting there and saying, you know, I'm doing this, but this really financially does not make any sense. This could very well be a midlife crisis and nothing else, right? I mean, should I put my family through all this if this is just a momentary thing, okay, and a very bad financial decision? At that time, there was an inquiry that was made by another company that effectively said, we have this position of director of research. You don't have to move very far. It was in the East Coast. It was working for somebody who I knew fairly well. It was a significant increase in salary, okay, but it did not have science at the bench. It was clearly, at that point, a high-level responsibility. This was at the time when that movie that created so many ripples, that was called The Last Temptation of Christ,
mm-hmm.
Came out. So Michelle described this as The Last Temptation of Saint Enrique. Okay, because it was almost, I mean, the movie was coming out at that time. He said, no, this is, you're being tempted one last time to make sure that this is what you really want to do. So I visited the company, they made the offer.
May I ask what the company was?
I'd rather not. It was a major chemical company,
sure.
That had it, well, only because it was kept pretty quiet at the time.
Oh, that's fine.
But it was remarkably effective.
Mm-hmm.
At making me decide to go to academia, because I said, if this is the step up from Exxon, okay, this takes me farther away from science. It doesn't have certainly there are financial upsides, but
right.
If I want a financial upside, okay, I can go back to the lab at Exxon and I can still get a reasonable salary. The house is paid for, okay, and I don't need to disrupt the family by doing that, okay. So that was the moment, I think, when after that last temptation, it sort of crystallized in my mind the fact that this was more than a midlife crisis. This is a moment in which you introspectively look at what you want to accomplish for the rest of your life, and you have a unique opportunity that may not materialize again, and you take a chance that is much more difficult for someone who is insecure, okay, about their ability to preserve their comfortable position, right? And this led to both a conversation with my father, but also a realization as to why it is that my father worked so hard when he didn't need to work so hard anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that he was insecure, that he wanted to make sure that he would never fall back again, okay? He was twice an immigrant,
right.
Okay, under unusual circumstances. He wanted to make sure that there was enough money that nobody would ever have to worry about it. In, I think because I only had to do it once and not twice, I was able to overcome the similar feeling that I had, that I should not give this up and be sort of poor in order to get, you know, this whim that I had of going and being an academic. And I had a conversation with my dad, and I had to, I remember that he was not very happy about it. He said, how can you leave a perfectly good job with a high salary at one of the most successful, I don't think you call it the most respected because it was after Exxon Valdez, but the most successful corporations in the world. They have great plans for you. You have a family, you have three kids, okay, and you're going to move them to California. And of all places in the world, to Berkeley, the place where communism started. Now, you have to realize he was a right wing. You know, he was on the Franco side of the Civil War. I mean, he was of all the places in the world. Okay, you have to go to the place where communism started. Okay, and that's when I decided I was coming to Berkeley, because there's this rebel that says that he might not say it. Well, okay, I'm gonna do it anyway. But it was financially very difficult at the beginning. I mean, the salary was 25% lower. Mm-hmm. The house was two and a half times the one that we sold.
Yeah.
We had to buy a house in either a reasonable school system or put our children in private school. And we did have a bit of a war chest, but not enough to really get us over the first 2 years. I mean, 2 years later, I think we would have had to do something fairly dramatic unless something happened. And what did happen was that, again, Michel Boudart came to the rescue again. He had a company called Catalytica that was thriving at the time. And I began by consulting with them. Then I became a scientific advisor. Then I became a senior scientific advisor. And, you know, that's the place when I got to meet the likes of Henry Tabi, of Eric Deruan, of Jim Coleman from Stanford. At the same level. For the first time, I was sitting at the table with a Nobel Prize winner, okay, and discussing where the electrons would go in this particular. And I was getting income that meant that there was no longer any negative numbers in my balance sheet. We were still not saving money,
right,
but at least we were not bleeding money,
right,
along the way. I have to say that, you know, the way that I tell my children right now is that most of us will die with more money than we need, but we don't have the money when we need it the most, okay? Which is a point in our lives where perhaps you are right now, where you're raising a family and trying to balance two jobs and all that. And then later on you realize that if you could only move some of the money now to the, you know, to that point before. So I'm a firm believer of getting in debt now, okay? Because I did get in debt to some extent, and everything worked out all right. But the last thing that I would say is that I had an interesting discussion, and then so at the time my two daughters were a little bit too young to have a serious discussion, but my son was about 11 at the time, and so I sat down with him at the dinner table when everybody else had left or was throwing a tantrum or something, and I said, you know, this may not make any sense to you right now, and actually to some of the people that look at this decision, it may not make any sense to them either, but in order for everybody to be happy, I need to be happy, and I'm not happy doing what I'm doing right now, mm-hmm. And you know, we're going to be poor for a while. That means that we may have to reuse our clothes more often. We'll have enough to eat. Don't worry about it. Okay, we'll manage. But you know, we're not going to be able to take family trips to Disney World on a regular basis. It's going to be tight. And you know, he sat there, and either he didn't realize the magnitude of the difference, or he actually was that thoughtful at the time. But he said, no, it doesn't matter, Dad. I think you should do whatever you think is the right thing to do. And money is not that important. Okay? An 11-year-old that says that money is not that important. This is why he was a terrible kid until the age of one. And then after that, he was actually quite reasonable throughout. And, you know, the touching thing about this conversation is that it repeated itself many years later. But the roles were reversed. Mm. So when he finished, when he was at the end of his PhD or so, he was trying to decide whether he would enter the corporate world. And you know, this was a time when a lot of the apps for iPhones and all that, and you know, Apple was hiring people with degrees in music and computer science. And he was trying to make a decision as to whether to join the corporate world or hang out and wait it out for an academic position. So we had a conversation at the dinner table, and so we talked about, you know, his options and all that. And I said, you know, but Dan, you know, if you wait for an academic position, you're going to struggle for a while until it comes up. You're not going to have very much disposable income and all that. And he said, well, you know, money is not that important. Okay. So. So I guess he was doing the same thing that I did, okay, sort of giving up something that was a certainty in financial stability for something that was ill-defined and certainly less, because he thought at the time that was the right thing to do.
Right.
It turns out that he has not been able to secure that academic position, which is why he's coming and finally joining the corporate world. But he has learned an awful lot, both about human beings and about his area, by doing as many things as he has done. He has worked for a small company. Mm-hmm. He has done contract consulting work. He has an artistic side that he has been able to develop in New York, and now will suffer here because he's not New York. So actually, he's a very different person and a much more unique individual as a result of it. And he did it at a significant sacrifice in income in order to be able to do that. So who knows, perhaps he won't leave Google one day and go into academia. But to me, when that conversation was like 10, 15 years later, you know, I'm the one that's telling him he should worry about money, right?
Yeah.
He's telling me that money doesn't matter. At the beginning, I was trying to convince him that, you know, money was not in. So watch out what you tell your children, because they will repeat it to you in your old age, okay? in some way. But I mean, that was a teary-eyed moment when we sat there, and he sort of, you know, we had this conversation. I said, I remember this, but he was only about yay big at the time. Now he's got a beard, and you know. So I think we raised all three of them to sort of worry about what matters, and I think even though it was very disruptive socially for all of them, I think they recognize that one makes sacrifices, you know, in order to accomplish something that one feels is important,
mm-hmm.
okay, and that may not always be the right economic decision, but you have to sort of do what you think will actually yield the returns. I think as a result of my coming here, I have been able to balance my life better
mm-hmm.
between family and work, in spite of the crazy life of the academic. It is a controlled crazy life.
Yeah.
It is not a tomorrow you have to go here because somebody woke up in a wrong mood and you have to go and have a meeting with somebody. Here the craziness is sort of long term and planned, okay? It is sometimes sort of monotonous in nature, but I like a certain level of reproducibility in my daily life. And the life as a manager at Exxon, I think, would have been a lot less accommodating of the balance between family and work than this is.
Interesting. Well, I think that's probably a really great place to stop, and aside from being the right time for us to stop. And tomorrow we'll be able to start up with how the research and how everything kind of has played out in your time here at Berkeley, and talk a little bit more about some of the science and all of that tomorrow.
Good. Yeah.
So I'll turn this off.
Yeah.